In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
Thank you for joining me today here on the I Spy Radio Show. It's been a while since we've had a new show, and I want to thank you for hanging in there with us as we deal with some serious health issues my wife, who's also my producer here, has had to deal with. The good news is she is out of the danger zone, and things had been very serious, life and death serious, and she is out of the hospital and in skilled nursing going through physical therapy. But things are taking longer than they would like due to some complications coming out of the hospital. They are thinking it's going to be at least another few weeks, so your prayers for her continued recovery are deeply appreciated. As for today's show, schools used to be a safe place for learning, but society's concept of schools appears to be changing, and they are no longer just about learning the basics of math and writing and science, and to be able to graduate with an understanding of those subjects. All too often we see schools shifting into indoctrination centers. And this is exemplified by the recent Biden administration changes to Title IX, the landmark civil rights case that protected the rights of girls and women in education, or it used to. But as these things go, we can be certain that they will try to bleed these changes into other aspects of society, including free speech. One of the more damning aspects of these Biden changes is the compelling of speech. Not free speech, compelling of speech of what you have to say. I don't think we'll get into it in this week's show because it's such a big issue, but according to the new rules, if you don't use someone's proper pronouns, your misgendering of them can be the basis for a sexual harassment claim. For the party that pretends it's for women, the Democrats and Joe Biden just got rid of women's rights in education. On today's show, the wholesale and willful destruction of Title IX. Sarah Parshall Perry is a senior legal fellow for the Edwin Meese Center for Legal and Judicial Studies at the Heritage Foundation, where she focuses on civil rights, constitutional governance, regulatory policy, and the proper role of courts. Sarah, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so we're going to talk a lot about Title IX today, but tell our audience a bit about yourself. From your bio, I see that you are a senior counsel to the Assistant Secretary for Civil Rights over at the U.S. Department of Education. So today's topic of Title IX is right up your alley.
Oh, yes. Not only is it up my alley, our administration, the office under which I worked, and my boss was Ken Marcus, who served as Secretary for Civil Rights before he left for the Brandeis Center and started doing great things. And in fact, speaking of education, has actually brought a pretty groundbreaking lawsuit against UC Berkeley for the failure of that university to address campus anti-Semitism. But what the Civil Rights Office does is enforce all of the nation's non-discrimination laws in education. So everyone thinks immediately that that's Title IX, but that is also Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act, the Individuals with Disabilities in Education Act, Title IV, Title VI, Title IX. So we have an entire panoply, but we work more like an enforcement agency, a law enforcement agency, than we do a legislative body. But under my rule, under my sort of operation at the Department of Education Civil Rights Office, we actually worked on a Title IX rule, and I had a chance to really kind of get down, dig deep into the sort of permutations of what this 52-year-old civil rights law actually meant, what its import was, how we could better enforce it at the ground level. But I took sort of a circuitous path to the Department of Education. I actually started out as a commercial litigator, then decided I didn't like suing people over things like, real property disputes and contracts and licensing issues, and it wasn't getting me up in the morning. And then I tried my hand at being in-house counsel, and the hours were great. I worked at an ad agency, which is a fun place to manage their interior legal work and business development. But then, you know, as is generally the case when you have children, your entire life changes. So I had three little ones in about 6 years, stayed home with them for the better part of 10 years, and then was actually approached by a friend and mentor of mine in Washington, D.C., who said that the Family Research Council needed someone to sort of evaluate and write a white paper on the Common Core state standards. Well, I had been really involved in my kids' education, and I had seen kind of what was coming through in the way of standardized curricula. And remember, this was a product of the Biden administration, right? So we were essentially held hostage by our own federal tax money, by the federal government, who said, we're going to unify testing, we're going to unify these standards. Now, of course, we're not teaching to the test. We're not forcing curriculum on you, wink, wink, but we're really forcing curriculum on you. And once I realized that pedagogically, these were not only the wrong standards, and I worked with Harvard and Stanford researchers, mathematicians, literature professors who said, wait a minute, these are really forcing American kids to think in a way that's not representative of how they learn. In fact, we were using, for example, we were seeing the use of something called the Asian model for mathematics, and that's where we use imagery and symbols to actually represent numbers as opposed to rote memorization. Well, I have two sons, very high functioning, but on the high end of the autism spectrum. And they're tremendous with rote memorization. In fact, you can ask them just about anything that you want on their favorite subject, and they will know it inside out and upside down. But you suddenly remove memorization, the times tables that you and I probably grew up with when we were using them to learn multiplication and addition and subtraction. And suddenly now those are being replaced with blocks. And one block is 100 and two blocks are 200. And so I really dug deep into what it looked like for our particular teachers, our administrators, to try to take what was very much an Asian model and something that was at the same time a backdoor entrance to social emotional learning and critical race theory and sort of social justice initiative.
It just astounds me how they have really laid the groundwork for those things, and they're so good at that, where they lay that groundwork for what's going to happen years in the future. We are coming up on a break, so Title IX is our focus today, and we'll dig into this in the coming segments. But just to give a taste of that discussion, is there any way to look at what the Biden administration has done to Title IX other than a complete destruction of Title IX?
No, there isn't, actually. And I've also used the terms evisceration and complete upending. So destruction works perfectly well because that's at bottom really what it is.
Yeah, the wood chipper of legal procedure. Okay, Title IX is our subject today. We're going to find out why it was so important to have and why it's so important to stop what Biden is doing to it. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.
Get a little more intelligence on big government. You're listening to the iSpy Radio Show.
And welcome back. We're talking about the dismantling of Title IX today, the law that used to protect women's rights in education, but the Biden administration has a covert war on women and tossed out those protections. Although I'm not sure how covert it is anymore. It seems like the hostilities are right out in the open right now. Our guest today is Sarah Parshall Perry. She's a senior legal fellow for the Heritage Foundation, and she has a deep background in education policy. And so, Sarah, you said going on to that last break that the Biden administration's rewriting of Title IX is just basically a complete destruction of it. So I think, though, to better understand what we've lost with this willful destruction of Title IX, I think we need to go back a little bit in history to remember what women had and how important that victory was when they got it. You know, a lot of people like myself, we sort of grew up with Title IX. So, of course, women should be treated equally in education. And so what women went through prior to Title IX is maybe a little bit lost on people. So set the historical stage for us. What was happening at the time where women needed those laws?
You know, it's interesting. It was at the height of the sexual revolution, really the women's movement. These were individuals like Gloria Steinem and Bella Abzug and Betty Friedan, who were sort of out in the streets and they were marching for women's equality, and they didn't need a man any more than a fish needed a bicycle, if you remember the famous statement from Gloria Steinem. So this is this was an era in which equality was very much top of mind. They tried and failed with the Equal Rights Amendment, and thankfully that has its own problems, too lengthy to get into in this segment. But they were successful in Title IX, and this was really their crowning achievement, right? Mm. Women's educational equality provided access not only to graduate schools and colleges, but single-sex admissions programs and scholarships, funding opportunities. It changed really the face of American education. Sports, I think, are the first thing people think of, but it really sort of took place in an era where it was just baseline equality in education. The language itself is only one sentence, strictly prohibiting any discrimination based on sex in federally funded education programs. So how a one-sentence missive in 1972 can become the mess, and it's 1,500 pages long of a mess, that it has now become under this administration, I think really sort of boggles the mind. But it was for women's equality, and yet here we are 52 years later, and we are completely back to where we started from.
Did I catch that? You said the revisions are 1,500 pages long?
They are 1,500 pages long.
Oh my
the
gosh.
Rule that just came out took me two reams of paper to print.
Oh my gosh. I had not heard that figure yet. Good gravy. So looking back at Title IX, is a good way to conceptualize what Title IX did was to make it so that whatever boys had access to in education, girls did as well.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think there was some debate at the time about whether or not sports should be included. But with a 1978 amendment, and after a great congressional debate, athletics regulations were incorporated, and that has remained the case untouched since 1978.
Hmm.
It was reauthorized in 1987 with the Civil Rights Restoration Act, but at no point did anyone think sex includes gender identity, and yet, again, here we are.
Well, yeah. So there were some exceptions to Title IX, such as traditionally one-gender organizations like Boy Scouts or Girl Scouts, they couldn't be forced to take the opposite sex. Fraternities and sororities, living conditions on campuses, and schools of religious organizations with religious beliefs contrary to Title IX. But, you know, as I was reading through those exceptions last night, I found it interesting that even within this landmark law, it acknowledged differences between males and females as part of the norms of society, acknowledged, you know, reality. Now, isn't that really what gave the law its strength, that acknowledgement of distinctions?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, in a United States Supreme Court case called U.S. versus Virginia, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, herself an arch feminist, wrote the majority opinion. And this was about whether or not women could be admitted to Virginia Military Institute. And one of her famous lines is that the two sexes are not fungible, and an environment of one is not the same as an environment of other. The differences between them are enduring. Now, that's big sort of representation coming from the nation's arch feminist and someone who left an indelible mark on the Supreme Court. She recognized that the sexes are different in 1992 with this opinion. There has never been, until Bostock versus Clayton County in 2020, and we can get to that, a recognition that sex and gender identity were anything even closely related to each other. And I think we've got all of this great Supreme Court precedent that the Biden administration has ignored. In fact, they've even taken a selective reading of some of the case law that conservatives and legal scholars of right mind have relied on and have said, wait a minute, the federal government is picking and choosing what it wants to apply here out of the entirety of these opinions. But truly, men and women are different. The founders, the drafters, the debaters of Title IX recognized it. The athletics regulations incorporated it, specifically accounting for separate facilities based on physiological differences. And again, all of that regulatory and congressional history, the Supreme Court history, this administration's ignoring it.
Yeah, absolutely. So As far as Title IX was concerned, because you had mentioned money earlier and the federal dollars, and that's how they get you, basically. I mean, at the time, was Title IX different than other regulations in that it specifically tied ending sexual discrimination to schools that got federal dollars? And because then if you got federal dollars, you could not discriminate based on sex. I guess, in other words, did Title IX open the door to that whole strings attached, or was that already a longstanding procedure at that point that if you got federal money, of course you had to take the strings that came with it?
So this was a law enacted under what's called the Constitution's spending clause. We hear a lot about interstate commerce, tax and spend. That's a power specifically that Congress has to say, we're going to give you federal money, but we're going to attach some strings to it. If we give you money, it's essentially the equivalent of engaging in a contract with you. We will give you money if you do X. And in this case, with non-discrimination law, this is not out of the ordinary. In fact, every institution who wants to receive public funding has to submit a certification. And this is sort of a little known trivia fact that maybe will be good for, you know, a game show later in life. Every federally funded institution has to submit to the Department of Education on the first of the year a certification saying we agree to abide by these six anti-discrimination provisions enforced by the Office for Civil Rights at Ed. And they're the ones that I mentioned, Title IV, Title VI, Title IX, Section 504, the IDEA. Those are the particular statutes that are required to be followed by anyone who desires to take federal money. So that's not beyond the pale. In fact, we've seen sort of tax and spend, spending clause legislation with everything from Medicare and Medicaid to Obamacare to you name a host of other actual federal programs that come down and trickle through into the state.
Yeah, it's absolutely how they control so many elements of society right now. Okay, it's time for a break. Coming up, we'll get into the heart of what the Biden administration's willful destructions of the protections that women and girls used to have in education. That and more with Sarah Parshall Perry, a senior legal fellow for the Heritage Foundation. Sarah Parshall Perry is a senior legal fellow for the Heritage Foundation, focusing on civil rights, constitutional governance, regulatory policy, and the proper role of courts. Love all of those, and we are talking about the dismantling of the landmark civil rights law, Title IX, which leveled the playing field for women and girls in education. And so we had said earlier there's really no way to look at what the Biden administration has done to Title IX other than a complete destruction of it. So can you elaborate a little bit on what exactly they have done?
Yeah, so I'd like to put its big problems, right, its big defects, into four different buckets. And let's start with the biggest, really the most nefarious one. They've expanded the definition of sex to include sexual orientation and gender identity. As we talked about a little bit and kind of teased earlier in the show, Mark, this is a massive expansion, not supported by the reading of the law, the underlying regulations, the congressional history, or Supreme Court history. To take the term sex, something that was guaranteed for women's equality in education, and now include gender identity or expression, which means, of course, any individual who is biologically male but feels like or expresses a female identity, no matter whether or not they're on hormones, have surgeries, look like a girl, act like a girl, these individuals are now gaining access to bathrooms, locker rooms, housing accommodations, dorm rooms, overnight accommodations, and sports teams. When we talk about equality, that notion of equality includes the recognition of physiological differences and their need, the women's girls' need for safe spaces, privacy spaces, and also for equal athletic opportunity. In fact, we wrote in the previous 2020 Title IX rule that I was a part of developing, that the reason we recognized sports teams in 1978 as an add-on to Title IX is because specifically we wanted them to have an opportunity, but separate from the men's team, because the physiological differences were so notable, so measurable, and so patent. That's the big change. But it's also going to set the groundwork for abortion as a civil right. Why? Because it includes language on termination of pregnancy or pregnancy and related characteristics among its anti-sex discrimination provisions. So you hear termination of pregnancy, a term that's never shown up in Title IX whatsoever. And now that is ultimately opening up the door for federally funded institutions to provide abortion counseling and, not too far down the road, abortion services at taxpayer expense to avoid losing their federal Title IX funding. But there are two more issues. First, it now incorporates preferred pronoun mandatory speech codes. Okay. How does it do this? Because in the terms, in the many, many pages through which I have been laboriously sort of reviewing, they include language saying that if you misgender a teacher or a student, that may be sufficient to mount a Title IX sex harassment claim. Well, I have to tell you, the Supreme Court has said just last term in 303 Creative versus Alenis, the Christian website designer case, when she didn't want to be forced to communicate a message by the state of Colorado in violation of her sincerely held religious beliefs, the Supreme Court made very clear our pluralistic republic has to abide by the Constitution, and no law is immune from the Constitution. That, I anticipate, can be very easily challenged in federal court. I don't think it'll take long before that happens. And then the fourth of these really bad defects is that individuals on college campuses, usually young men, but sometimes young women as well, who are accused of sexual misconduct, are generally investigated by a single individual on college campuses, an unelected bureaucrat who generally does not have much background, if at all, in criminal investigation or enforcing civil rights law, and yet they do not get a tribunal of impartial sort of determiners. They have one individual who is going to act as judge, jury, and executioner. They don't have access to the evidence brought against them. They can only be represented by counsel if they make a specific demand for that. And in many instances, these individuals can be tarred and marred by these particular proceedings if these are false accusations for the rest of their lives. So we've seen an elimination of due process, a violation of the First Amendment, a violation of civil rights law, and a violation of administrative law. It is truly one of the most illegal rulemakings I think I've ever seen.
Wow. A lot to unpack there. Just listening to what you're saying, it's almost like they're making university campuses just completely unappealing for the next generation here. As far as the original intent of Title IX, it was to protect women and girls in education. Do these revisions protect women and girls in education at all, or are the rights of biological women no longer relevant?
Well, that's exactly it. I think the short answer to the question is they are no longer relevant, and here's why. When you have chosen an identified population that by most estimates is less than 1%, even as fast, as rapidly as we're seeing it growing among adolescent populations, we could have a whole separate discussion on the fact that that's not organic. That is a result of social contagion and what we're seeing coming out of the highest levels of government. But even assuming the fast rate of increase among adolescent populations, this is less than 1% of the population. Women constitute more than 51% of the population. Why would you set up the claims of biological women against trans-identified males in places like sports, bathrooms, locker rooms, dormitories, housing accommodations, and speech codes? It makes literally no sense. Where is the Title IX that our grandmothers enjoyed and that our mothers enjoyed? It is now, thanks to the Biden administration, on the chopping block entirely. He's sacrificed equality for this government's notion of equity and advancing the interests of a small, vocal, and well-funded minority simply to essentially make a politically craven power play toward his progressive base in an election year.
Yeah, I just cannot wrap my head around it. It just makes no sense that women tend to be more Democrats, and yet they're throwing out any rights and protections for women. Okay, this next question I have for you is going to take a bit, so let's take a break a little bit early. We're talking about the dismantling of what used to protect women and girls and Education Title IX. More with Sarah Parshall Perry, Senior Legal Fellow from the Heritage Foundation. Welcome back. We're talking about the Biden administration blowing up Title IX today. That's the civil rights law that used to protect girls and women in education. And we're honored to be joined by Sarah Parshall Perry, a senior legal fellow for the Heritage Foundation. And we were talking about the dismantling here of all rights to protect women. And so these revisions that the Biden administration has put through allow biological women, or I'm sorry, allow biological men not just access to women's sports, but also to women's bathrooms, changing areas, and showers. So wherever a woman can go, a biological male can be right there with her. But to gain access to those areas, do the men have to, I don't know, demonstrate in any way that they really are a transgender, or can just any biological male simply walk into any woman's bathroom or showers because they feel like looking at naked women, or feel like exposing themselves to those women?
Listen, I have three kids. They're all teenagers, and two of them are teenage boys, 15 and 19, and it took very little for my 15-year-old boy to recognize opportunistically, Ma, I mean, does that mean all I have to say is I'm a girl and I can walk into the girls' locker room? And I said, well, first of all, don't get any ideas, but yes, absolutely it does. I mean, this isn't even lost on the populations of pubescent and prepubescent individuals that are going to be subject to these rules. So it requires absolutely no manifestation. And you and I know, Mark, that there's no way you could actually change your biological sex anyway. So we actually just saw a very interesting case out of West Virginia. And this kind of puts a really sort of refined, I think, light on this particular issue. It's a case called BPJ versus West Virginia, just decided out of the Fourth Circuit. Alliance Defending Freedom is working actually with the West Virginia Solicitor General's office. It's possibly going to appeal to the Supreme Court before the end of the term. That remains to be seen. But in long story short, that panel of three judges determined that it was a violation of Title IX to not let a middle school boy who identified as a girl to run on the girls' track team. Now, let me tell you, for as long as he had been competing, he actually beat more than 100 girls 280 times over during the level of his competition in the span of two short years. Hmm. 100 young girls were beat by a biological boy. And here's the kicker. He has been on puberty blockers for 3 years. So if you don't think there's a meaningful difference between the ability of the sexes, regardless of whether or not you're on puberty blockers, regardless of whether or not you have body modification surgery, it boggles the mind that this administration, in many respects, isn't this sort of a tacit admission that they're recognizing there's nothing you can do to really change who you are on the inside. So we're just going to throw up our arms and say, identify however you want, express whatever way you want. And then you get access to anything you want. Well, for those of us in a category that are protected by what's called immutability, and the Supreme Court has clarified in a case called Frontiero versus Richardson, that is a characteristic given to you by accident of birth, like race, like sex, like national origin. That's something you can do nothing about. It's just exactly who you are as a person. Those categories deserve special protections under the Equal Protection Clause, but never has the Supreme Court said you deserve special protection because you identify a certain way or because you think a certain way. We're going to treat you the same that we treat someone who's been historically disadvantaged by an immutable characteristic. Hmm. They won't find that. I think I would bet my paycheck on the fact that if a case like this goes to the Supreme Court, you've got at least six right-thinking justices who are going to say, we're not going to expand civil rights protections to individuals based on how they may feel Monday when that could change Friday. And sure, now we've completely turned civil rights law upside down. But it just indicates the patent insanity, not only of the Biden rule, but of this case we just saw coming out of West Virginia. They held that boy's interest to be superior to the interests of those biological girls against whom he was competing. And yeah, wouldn't you know, the next day after this decision came down, a series of track girls on a middle school team competing opposite BPJ's team took their marks on the starting block, stood up and walked off the field.
Good for them.
As a protest to say, we will not do this anymore.
Good for them. So we were talking about men just walking into women's showers. What about other more absurd situations? For example, where a 30-year-old male identifies as a third-grade girl. Under these new rules, would he be allowed to go to school and shower with little girls?
See, isn't that the $64,000 question? When a problem like this, when the Biden administration's expansion to now include how you feel about yourself as equivalent to the same as how you were born, you really have no self-limiting principle. And in fact, I have now begun to see, God help us, accounts on Twitter who are uncovering not only individuals who are arguing for pedophilia to be replaced by minor attracted persons,
yeah,
to now the trans ageism community. And you are exactly right when you say, what's to prevent a biological male from identifying as an 11-year-old girl to gain access to a middle school girl's bathroom? The short answer is nothing, because there is no self-limiting principle. If we don't hold the line on black and white and the biological reality, we've thrown everything up in the air.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, when you open the door, a lot of crazy people and crazy things are going to walk right into that. So Title IX was the crowning achievement of the women's rights movement. Do you think back in 1972 when this was passed, do you think the women involved who had fought so hard for this had even the remotest inkling that something like this might happen?
I don't. I really don't. And, you know, there were some sort of sexually divergent communities at the time.
Sure.
We know this was roughly along the era of Stonewall and the sort of rise of the gay movement out in San Francisco. But there was never a belief that men were women. Men could invade women's spaces. And in fact, a lot of the women who've taken a great deal of impact from this expansion from the Biden administration are lesbians. And here's why: because these women have fought a long time, not only within the community, the LGBT community, to try to gain equality, to gain recognition, but now they're finding themselves disenfranchised by the hard left, and they're finding themselves needing to align with conservatives on an issue as basic as biological reality. And we have appreciated so deeply these lesbian women coming alongside conservative women, and we don't agree on anything else. Don't ask us to talk about religion,
really,
or abortion or the definition of the nuclear family, but on this, we can stand side by side and say, listen, this is an issue we can all get behind, and all of us are suffering the exact same way. So I don't even think during the late 60s and early 70s that there was ever a comprehension that we would be where we are right now. Otherwise, the language would have been precisely to exclude gender identity. But why would you? If the common vernacular, if what the Supreme Court's called the plain and ordinary meaning of the word at the time of the law's enactment in 72 meant sex, because everyone understood it,
yeah,
to mean male and female, then I think they're just as blindsided by this as we are.
Oh, the world is just so upside down right now. Okay, let's go ahead and take a break. It's not just about biological men in biological women's sports and locker rooms. This is also impacting other rights. That next, and trying to get a handle on why the left is doing that, with Sarah Parshall Perry.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
Sarah Parshall Perry is a senior legal fellow for the Heritage Foundation, where she focuses on civil rights, constitutional governance, regulatory policy, and the proper role of courts. And we're talking today about Title IX, the landmark civil rights case that used to protect women and girls in education, but that's been thrown out in favor of woke ideology. And as far as this whole new ruling goes, these kinds of things never seem to stay in their own sandbox. Do you see the new rules of Title IX bleeding over into other aspects of law or society? And if so, where?
Oh, there's absolutely no doubt. And, you know, here's how this started. And I think that's going to kind of help inform what happens next. The president, on the first day in office, issued an executive order directing all of his federal agencies, every cabinet, right? So HHS, HUD, Department of Justice, Education, all of them, to take every one of their federal anti-sex discrimination provisions. And there are more than 100 federal laws and regulations specifically prohibiting sex discrimination, right? So that's a lot of laws that apply to the lives of everyday average Americans. And he directed every cabinet secretary to take the definition of sex and include it to expand it to include gender identity or expression. So that means this is not just what's happening in education. It's also happening, for example, in healthcare. And this is a little known fact. Title IX is actually offering up the definition for sex that now the Department of Health and Human Services uses for Medicaid, Medicare, and Obamacare funding. Remember, we talked about that spending clause spending. So this is more conditional spending. So now you're going to have religious hospitals or religious doctors who are in desperate need of federal funding, wants to be able to treat and take these patients on Medicaid or Medicare, or be able to receive Affordable Care Act funding. And they're going to be forced to violate their sincerely held religious beliefs because they don't want to perform a double mastectomy on a healthy 13-year-old girl. But that, a failure to do so, is now discriminatory under HHS's definition of sex discrimination. So here we go into healthcare. What is going to be the right of opt-out? What are we going to see hospitals faced with? Mm. What are we going to see in terms of individuals bringing discrimination lawsuits saying, I'm not being taken care of by this hospital, I feel discriminated against? We're also going to see this in school lunches. Another unknown, sort of little known trivia fact about Title IX. Title IX's definition of sex discrimination also appears in the Food, Drug, and Nutrition Act, enforced by the USDA. That's the school lunch money program, specifically for children who are on a reduced lunch program or receive what's called SNAP benefits. These are kids for whom their only hot meal a day may be at their public school. Well, if a public school does not post a non-discrimination provision on its wall saying that all bathrooms are open to any individual, all sports teams are open to any individual, the kids who are now going to suffer are not just the school itself or lack of federal Title IX funding, but individual children who are on reduced lunch programs through federal nutritional aid benefits. That, to my mind, is unconscionable. So it's not only sort of the tip of the spear is very wide and very deep.
So this is also more than just protecting women's rights in education. It's also about protecting young girls. And to the larger picture, you know, we talked about this creeping into other elements of society. I mean, this is really, I think, when it boils down to it, it's an assault on the innocence of children and about protecting kids from adults who are determined to force their sexuality on kids. And it's also an assault on parental rights. So how do we protect children from this? Do we need a parental bill of rights of some sort?
Yes, I love that perspective. We've seen some of the states get involved with offering up, and in some cases, like we see in Florida, parental bill of rights legislation. I am a fan of also doing what we can at the federal level, because the Constitution, our Supreme Court's recognized that in the 14th Amendment, while it specifically doesn't say we recognize parental rights to be part of our ordered liberty, we have recognized for more than 100 years, starting with Meyer versus Nebraska in 1923, that raising a child, getting the freedom to raise your child as you want, educate them as you want, inculcate your beliefs as you want, has a long tradition that precedes the Constitution. It's one of our oldest natural rights, as Justice Sandra Day O'Connor wrote in Troxell versus Granville. So we've got 100 years of jurisprudence at our back. When we relinquish our children to federally funded schools, and remember, I want to say something about the applicability of Title IX. This isn't just public schools and public universities, right? We're not just talking, you know, Penn State and SEC schools and Auburn University. We're talking preschool, Head Start programs, private schools that accept funding, charter schools that accept funding, vocational schools, trade schools, K through 12, college, graduate schools, private, I mean, and public. This, I can't tell you how many of the proportions to which this individual rule applies. It's going to be many more institutions that are subject to it than are not. So once we recognize exactly how wide and vast the application is, it makes the case for strengthening parental rights, both at the grassroots and the federal level, that much stronger. I'm actually in the process of getting ready to publish a legal brief on this, specifically addressing what happens in these schools that have gender support policies. And these include that element of confidentiality, right? Where now we see school administrators and school teachers hiding gender identity information about minor children from their parents.
Wow. Yep.
Not only constitutionally noxious, it is morally repugnant.
Oh,
it is against the entire American tradition.
Yeah.
I can't wait to get the paper out. It's long, but it's going to give us, I think, a lot more to talk about. But parental rights is right in the mix.
Oh, absolutely it is. Okay, we are up against the clock. Everyone stay with us. We'll wrap up with Sarah Parcel Perry, Senior Legal Fellow for the Heritage Foundation, talking about Title IX. And welcome back. We're in our final segment now with Sarah Parcel Perry. She's from the Heritage Foundation, where she's a senior legal fellow. And we've been talking about the destruction of Title IX. And so looking forward here, I mean, what's it going to take to reverse this revision? I mean, can all the women that are out there sue the government for removing these protections after working so hard to get them in the first place? And are there already legal challenges underway?
Yes, and I'm happy to report there are. I know of four federal challenges that are currently in development right now with litigators to whom I am very closely aligned. I will tell you it's going to take a three-prong analysis, and I'll run down these very simple. First, it's going to take, as you mentioned, litigation. We are going to need lawsuits all across the country challenging this law. I've told you it's a violation of constitutional law, civil rights law, a violation of administrative law. You can take the parents' rights angle, women's rights angle, immutable characteristics angle, First Amendment angle, Administrative Procedure Act angle, multiple angles. Challenges will come. They are already in development. I suspect them fast and furious. The second is a Congressional Review Act challenge from either the House or the Senate. The U.S. House, the U.S. Senate have an opportunity under something called the Congressional Review Act to downvote a rule by a two-thirds vote in either chamber and send it to the president's desk saying we have no confidence in this rule, we find it to be illegal. Now, unfortunately, the president gets a right of ultimate veto, and yes, that will happen, but it is important because it tolls the clock. They must take all 60 days of that window to stem the tide on the enforcement date, which is August 1st. So Congress can act, litigators can act, and then here's what also needs to happen, and I'm so pleased. I just tweeted about this the other day to see this happening in the states. We're now seeing red state governors and red state superintendents of schools jump in and say, we're not following it. We have our own sports laws on the books. We have our own sex definition laws on the books. We have our own parental rights laws on the books. It's illegal. It conflicts with state law. Take our money. We don't care. We will not comply with your definition under Title IX. I am so excited to represent the Texas, Florida, Louisiana, and a few others are already mulling these particular types of actions. Seven state superintendents of schools are also about to get involved. This is going to be a red state revolt that I don't think this administration anticipated. Because, of course, federal funding, right, that's the carrot and the stick. Don't we all want our federal tax dollars back, particularly in this inflationary economy? But these states have said, that's it. We're not following your rule. And I am so encouraged. I'm so gratified to see the level of courage, and hopefully we'll see more of it.
Well, I would certainly hope that this isn't just a red state revolt. I hope a lot of blue states revolt on this, because this is so infringing on parental rights and the rights of women. I just hope it's not just red states on this. In terms of overruling this, I mean, the Supreme Court has made it pretty clear that they are not in favor of administrations just simply overriding or rewriting, I should say, of existing laws. And so I would certainly think that this would fail at the Supreme Court. I guess the question is why do this if there's such clear and compelling legal precedents against what they're doing?
Well, they have picked and chosen the legal precedent that they want, and they've gotten some expansive case law out of the Second Circuit and the Fourth Circuit, and boy, they are holding on for dear life. But there's contrary case law in the Fifth, in the Sixth, in the 11th, and at the Supreme Court. So this is really going to come down to whose interpretation governs. Well, we, of course, know that the Supreme Court's going to get the final say, but no legally correct, no legally sound reading of Title IX and any of the attendant case law is supported by what the Biden administration thinks it is. And you mentioned rightly that the Supreme Court has been really frustrated with the Biden administration's attempt to take federal law, to which they are tasked with enforcing and applying, and sort of twisting and turning it to fit its particular motives. I give you West Virginia versus EPA from last Supreme Court term. You cannot, as the Supreme Court said, create a rule of vast economic and political significance without going through the appropriate congressional challenges and the appropriate congressional process, and not just plucking it out of thin air. They did the same thing with the Fair Housing Act eviction moratorium during COVID. Again, the exact Fair Housing Act argument came into play there. The Supreme Court said, sorry, statute doesn't support it. You don't have a reading that's correct on this. So now we've gotten two for two. I think this is very likely going to be three for three and possibly the biggest defeat they suffer yet.
I would certainly hope so. Well, I know that even just recently there was a 9-0 ruling throwing out the EPA water rules, basically giving private property rights back to property owners. So I really hope that this unites the Supreme Court against this, because it is absolutely insane. Sarah Parshall Perry, I want to thank you so much for your time. We'd love to have you back sometime.
Thanks so much for having me. It's great to be on.
For all you parents out there, I tell you, if you ever needed an argument for school choice, the Biden administration doing away with girls' rights and throwing women and girls aside, that is just about the best argument you can get. You know, I was thinking during the show what an odd juxtaposition this is. On the one hand, Democrats claim they are for women's rights, but when they had the chance to protect the rights of actual women over biological men, the Democrats chose men. You heard Sarah. Women's rights in education are effectively gone. Ladies, doesn't that just seem a bit odd? Oh, they want you to be able to get rid of your own babies, but for some reason, they just don't really seem to like you. You know, when it comes to women and Democrats, it's an abusive relationship, and you need to get out of it. Don't be afraid of conservatives. Don't believe the lies you've been told by Democrats about conservatives. Conservative women are real women, and they want real rights for women. Come on over to the right side. Because as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.